of fate rolls on like a juggernaut and crushes us all in turn, some soon, some late. It does not matter when, in the end, it crushes us all. We do not prostrate ourselves before it like the poor Indians. We fly hither and thither. We cry for mercy, but it is of no use. The black fate thunders on, and in its season reduces us to powder. Poor Harry to go so soon. Just when his life was opening to him. He was doing so well at the hospital. He had passed his last examination with honours, and I was proud of them. Much prouder than he was, I think. And then he must needs go to that smallpox hospital. He wrote to me that he was not afraid of smallpox and wanted to gain the experience. And now the disease has killed him. And I, old and grey and withered, am left to mourn over him, without a chick or child to comfort me. I might have saved him, too. I have money enough for both of us, and much more than enough. King Solomon's Mines provided me with that. But I said, no, let the boy earn his living, let him labour, that he may enjoy rest. But the rest is come to him before the labour. Oh, my boy! My boy! I am like the man in the Bible, who laid up much goods and builded barns, goods for my boy, and barns for him to store them in. And now his soul has been required of him, and I am left desolate. I would that it had been my soul and not my boy's. We buried him this afternoon, under the shadow of the grey and ancient tower of the church of this village, where my house is. It was a dreary December afternoon, and the sky was heavy with snow, but not much was falling. The coffin was put down by the grave, and a few big flakes lit upon it. They looked very white upon the black cloth. There was a little hitch about getting the coffin down into the grave. The necessary ropes had been forgotten, so we drew back from it and waited in silence, watching the big flakes fall gently, one by one, like heavenly benedictions, and melt in tears on Harry's pall. But that was not all. A robin redbreast came as bold as could be, and lit upon the coffin and began to sing. And then I am afraid that I broke down, and so did Sir Henry Curtis, strong man though he is. And as for Captain Good, I saw him turn away too. Even in my own distress, I could not help noticing it. The above, signed Alan Quatermain, is an extract from my diary written 2 years and more ago. I copy it down here because it seems to me that it is the fittest beginning to the history that I am about to write, if it please God to spare me to finish it. If not, well, it does not matter. That extract was penned 7,000 miles or so from the spot where I now lie, painfully and slowly writing this, with a pretty girl standing by my side, fanning the flies from my august countenance. Harry is there, and I am here. And yet somehow I cannot help feeling that I am not far off, Harry. When I was in England, I used to live in a very fine house, at least I call it a fine house, speaking comparatively, and judging from the standard of the houses I have been accustomed to all my life in Africa, not 500 yards from the old church where Harry is asleep. And thither I went after the funeral and ate some food, for it is no good starving, even if one has just buried all one's earthly hopes. But I could not eat much, and soon I took to walking, or rather limping, being permanently lame from the bite of a lion, up and down the oak-panelled vestibule. For there is a vestibule in my house in England. On all the four walls of this vestibule were placed pairs of horns, about 100 pairs altogether, all of which I had shot myself. They are beautiful specimens, as I never keep any horns which are not in every way perfect, unless it may be now and again on account of the associations connected with them. In the centre of the room, however, over the wide fireplace, there was a clear space left, on which I had fixed up all my rifles. Some of them I've had for 40 years. Old muzzle loads.